of the omnibus edition of My Name is Why, in which Lem Sisay, the award-winning poet, reads from his frank memoir about growing up in Britain's care system in the 70s and 80s while musing on the redemptive power of poetry. Lem begins his courageous account with his early days in foster care.
At 14, I tattooed the initials of what I thought was my name into my hand. The tattoo is still there, and it wasn't my name. I was not who I thought I was. The authority knew it, but I didn't. The authority were writing reports about me from the day I was born. My first footsteps were followed by the click-clack-clack of a typewriter. Papers zipped from typewriters and into files. For 18 years, this process repeated over and over again. Click, clack, clack. The folders were taken out and placed on tables surrounded by men and women from the authority. Put him here. Move him there. Shall we try drugs? Try this? Try that? After 18 years of experimentation, the authority threw me out. It locked the doors securely behind me and hid the files in a data company called the Iron Mountain. So I wrote to the authority. Customer services replied to say they were not permitted to release the files. The authority placed me with incapable foster parents. It imprisoned me. It moved me from institution to institution. And yet now, at 18 years old, I had no history, no witnesses, no family. In 2015, following a 30-year campaign to get my records, the chief executive of Wigan Council, Donna Hall, wrote me a letter. She had them. Within a few months, I received four thick folders of documents. On reading them, I knew. I took the authority to court. Awake amongst the lost and found, the files left on the open floor, the frozen leaves on frosted ground, the frosted keys in a frozen door. 18 years of records written by strangers. All the answers to all my questions were here, possibly. And yet I feared what they'd reveal. Maybe I was loved. Maybe my mother didn't want me. Maybe it was all my fault. St. Margaret's House was an institution for unmarried mothers, affiliated to the Board of Moral Welfare. On 30th of June 1967, the state registered nurse writes that Lemian Sisay, misspelt, was free from infectious diseases and that the six-week-old baby weighed 9 pounds. In a letter written by Dr. Bernardo's to Norman Goldthorpe, children's officer for Wigan Authority, I'm 6 months old. At this point, my mother is invisible.
Dear Mr. Goldthorpe, further to your inquiry regarding the possibility of our adoption department being able to place a part Ethiopian, part Greek baby boy for adoption, our senior adoption officer has written to us asking that she be supplied with details of his background and whether Ethiopian means he is Negroid or not.
Then there was a photo on the back of which it says
Norman Sisay.
So my name was changed to Norman Sisay. I'm supposed to be part Greek. An adoption agency asks whether Ethiopian means he is Negroid or not. This is the first time I have seen myself referred to as Norman Sisay. In England, unmarried pregnant women were placed in mother and baby homes like St. Margaret's. Many of them didn't understand the full implication of the word adoption. They were sent home without their newborn after signing the adoption papers. My mother would not sign the adoption papers. Without my mother's signature on the adoption papers, the authority could not adopt me. So Norman Goldthorpe defied her and assigned me to long-term foster parents, Catherine and David Greenwood. My foster parents told me some years later that I was alone in the hospital because no one would adopt a coloured baby. They said they chose me after praying to God and that my mother didn't want me. My mother must have been at her most vulnerable. She was pregnant and alone in a foreign country where she'd come to study for a short period of time. I was 3.5 years old when the authorities served a notice on my mother via her church in Ethiopia to say that all rights and powers of the parent of Lem Cisse be vested in the local authority, it appearing that the parent has abandoned this child. She was given 1 month to object to the notice. The notice would have taken a month to arrive in Ethiopia and another month for the letter to return. It was an impossible deadline. My story begins without her or any knowledge of her. The Greenwoods and I lived in a semi-detached house with a solid red brick gable end wall. We attended Bryn Baptist on Wednesday and Sunday. It's where our friends and family were, and we prayed. At breakfast, at lunch, at dinner. There was good and bad in the world.
Ничего не пишите.
Пишите.
Ничего не читайте.
Читайте.
Ничего не говорите.
Ничего не печатайте.
There was darkness and light, black and white. On 29th of May 1968, my file reports,
Norman is a healthy, contented child. The foster parents are devoted to him. He's a very affectionate child with large, appealing eyes.
Christopher, the Greenwoods' firstborn child, my little brother, came along in July. And on 15th of October 1968, it is reported,
Norman is very good with the new baby. He has got over his initial jealousy. Mrs. Greenwood is an excellent little mother.
Sarah was born 2 years after Christopher and 8 years later came Helen. Only 14 months apart in age, Christopher and I fought like brothers. Cats and dogs had nothing on us. I adored him. When it came to the colour of my skin, my parents referred to me as chocolate. No one told me I was the same colour as Martin Luther King or Muhammad Ali. Racist comments from the outer world became more frequent. Mum and Dad's response was to tell me to ignore it or that we are all God's children. My mum fostered a coloured baby in 1967, in a time of racial intolerance in England. Some smiled and stopped me in the pram, and others spat on the back of her coat as she walked by. Years later, they'd do the same to me. So whatever this racism was, it would be the shadow to the light of their love. I was a happy child. Mum had short black hair and dark eyes. For ages, I'd pray that she'd sit on the edge of my bed and sing me to sleep as she did when I was younger. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are grey. I believed her. Dad was broody, tall, witty and silent. The front room was his library. Cornerstone books for me were the Bible, the famous five series, and The Lion, The Witch and The Wardrobe. I don't remember other novels or poetry except T.S. Eliot's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, which was my favourite. Mum and Dad said I was like McCavity. It felt affectionate then, but later I realised something wasn't right. McCavity was dark, quick, and a thief. On 11th of December 1974, the social worker wrote,
There are no problems with Norman. Mrs. Greenwood considers him as theirs. The foster parents have spoken of adoption, but they are afraid that investigations may lead to his mother. Norman is said to be exceptionally bright. He's very aware of his colour and often asks why he could not have been born to a white lady.
I was a questioner. In the Baptist church, we were taught to question why. The answer was often, because we are sinners. At school, I was subject to all kinds of questions about my race, which I couldn't answer. I brought all these questions home. She left you. She didn't want you. If I find her, I will scratch her eyes out. My mum's love was elevated by how much she hated my birth mother for leaving me. I'm 7. This is what my social worker writes.
Mr. and Mrs. Greenwood realised that there may be many problems ahead with Norman, as well as a lot of happiness.
I developed a sense that there was something wrong with me around the time I began attending junior school. My social worker reports.
After the school holidays, Christopher will be starting at the same school. And it will be interesting to see what happens, because Norman does not like Christopher to be better than him at anything.
None of what I've told you so far is true. I wasn't a happy child. I was a deceitful one. I was causing problems for everyone. It must be true.
January 1976. Spoke to Mr. Graves several times on the phone and eventually visited the school. He felt that Norman's successes were too many for his brother to cope with. Went on to talk about another placement. I put it to him that it was the only home the boy had known.
I was 9. My brother Christopher was 8. I showed my love for him by punching him. We fought with unbridled determination, the way brothers do, until one of us, invariably Christopher, would burst into tears. Catherine and David had no children when they took me. Christopher was their firstborn, but I was their first. I was the eldest. I loved my family. The head teacher suggesting to the social worker that I be moved for the sake of Christopher could not have happened in isolation. This inclines me to think my foster parents must have spoken to the head teacher. On 28th of July 1975, the social worker visited.
I called to see Norman today, the family having just returned from a holiday in Scotland. Mrs. Greenwood was upset. It seems that Norman had been getting up in the early hours and eating sweet foods, particularly biscuits, as many as 2 packets.
For the record, I did steal biscuits, but not 2 whole packs. One holiday in Scotland, at my granddad's home, the family left me in the cottage as punishment for lying about stealing some cake. I thought I'd been locked in my room, but the door was open. I sobbed my way downstairs. I saw on the table a half-cut ginger cake. The tears evaporated, replaced by butterflies in my stomach. If I cut it in exactly the same way as it was already cut, then nobody would notice that I had taken a slice. Genius! And so I did. It tasted so good. So I did it again. To this day, I don't know why I got into this habit of stealing biscuits and bits of cake, but I did. They told me I was devious. The problem was that my first instinct was to say, I didn't steal the cake. The lies worried them more than the theft. Stealing cake and lying about it was an indication that the devil was working inside of me. Within 3 years, it will be reported that I threatened to kill the entire family except for baby Helen. Look what was sown by the stars at night across the fields. I am not defined by scars, but by the incredible ability to heal. It was run by the elders, Bryn Baptist Church, a mile from our home and a mile from Grandma and Grandad Munro. Church was full of horrific stories, people drowned in the huge flood, and Jesus stabbed with huge nails and hung on a wooden cross. Repent, repent for your sins. The temperature rose with the pastor's words. Mum threw up her arms, praise him. So I threw up mine. Was I saved by Jesus? I spent 12 years kneeling and praying, and it was the powerful rhetoric and lyricism of the church that took me to poetry. There is barely any mention of religion in my files. It wasn't discussed with a social worker.
The child has an extrovert personality and is attention-seeking. The foster parents' own children are somewhat overshadowed by this child.
Winnick was a sprawling red brick institution set in manicured greenery. Mum, me and Chris walked through the front door, and after Mum signed a register, we stepped into the wide, tiled corridor of the asylum. Our footsteps led to a big public room with lots of winged armchairs with women in them. Mum spotted one of them and stepped quietly over to her. She had an overhang to her mouth, wolf-like, hair like a nest, and she was rocking backwards and forwards. Say hello to your auntie. Hello, auntie. A twisted elbow pushed out a clawed hand towards me and brushed my cheek. She couldn't speak. Mum took out a hanky and lovingly wiped drool from Auntie's mouth and chin, and I knew instinctively not to ask questions. Mum visited her twin regularly, sometimes alone, sometimes with us. My auntie had been like that from birth. My grandmother never visited her daughter with my mum and us. Did my mum blame herself? Was Catherine living with a constant sense that she was not good enough because she had taken the heir from her twin sister? She would do everything to prove otherwise. She would foster a black baby and show her mother that she was good. I saw Grandma at least once a week and I loved her. Maybe she did love Catherine, the twin that survived. But Catherine never felt it and subsequently found love difficult to give. Mum was a state-registered nurse. At the hint of a scratch or bump, she'd draw the medical kit from the top of the kitchen cabinet. I'm not sure I ever felt as close to her than when she'd say, "This is going to hurt," before dabbing my grey's knee with a pinch of cotton wool soaked in witch hazel. It's because she was a nurse that she had the comb. Each morning before school, I'd stand by the heater in the kitchen, and Mum dragged the comb through the roots until my skull felt like it had been dipped in acid. "You have hair sore," she'd say. Apparently, hair sore was a medical condition. Then, on a spring day, Mum got me up in my best shirt and trousers. I was going to meet a pop star. Errol Brown was the lead singer for Hot Chocolate. Mum took me to an apartment in Winstanley. I remember there were bowls of nuts and crisps, and it wasn't even Christmas. Errol Brown chatted to me about school. He was black, like me. I was nervous and intrigued all at the same time, and then he left the room and came back with a present for me. I stared at the strange and elegant genius of design, an afro comb. He'd been visiting a newborn child of a family friend at the hospital. Mum was the midwife on call, and they must have got talking about me. Maybe she showed him the thin-toothed comb she'd been using. Maybe he winced and gritted his teeth to stop him saying, "His hair is Ethiopian hair. Why did you not get this boy an afro comb?" On 19th of April 1978, the social worker writes,
"There is a letter on file from Norman's mother, written in 1968, requesting that he be returned to her in Ethiopia. Perhaps Norman should be made aware of this."
And underneath, a handwritten comment,
"Not yet, I think."
The social worker's report continues,
The Greenwoods are seen by Norman as his parents.
Why would the social worker say that? They told me they were my parents forever. Why would I think anything else? As with most brothers close in age, Christopher and I fought like snakes on each other's territory. Christopher always, even in the midst of thrills, betrayed a fretfulness. I had no idea that Mum thought it was my fault. We raced each other home from school every single day, and every single day I beat him. I waited in the kitchen by my mum. He dived into Mum's arms and said, "Mum, Mum, I beat Norman, didn't I?" She stroked his head, and then she looked at me. "Yes, you did." 1973. I've only two school reports from my infants and junior schools.
Norman is a carefree and happy child and is an asset to the class. His lively personality makes him popular with the other children.
11th of July, 1978. My junior school report. I am 11 years old.
Norman is an enthusiastic worker. He is cooperative and eager to please. Norman is a most likeable boy. A ray of sunshine.
12th of July, 1978. The social worker's response.
Discussed Norman with Miss Jones, who has a quite pathetic attitude towards the child, purely based on his colour. See recent report where she refers to him as ray of sunshine. Hopefully the staff at his new school will be more realistic.
December 1978, the social worker reports that Mrs. Greenwood had a daughter. Her name was Helen. It was an unexpected pregnancy. The household now had four children and two adults. The social worker received a phone call on 13th of May 1979, 8 days before my 12th birthday.
Phone call from Mrs. Greenwood. A row with Norman had resulted in him threatening to kill all members of the family, except baby Helen. Mrs. Greenwood had reacted by packing him off to her mother's visit, and Mrs. Greenwood very upset. The row had developed from Norman badgering Chris to loan him his cricket stumps. Mrs. Greenwood had advised Chris not to loan them, as Norman is extremely careless with equipment. Norman had told Chris that the decision was his and not their mum's. Mrs. Greenwood lost her temper and told him to leave.
Home was hell. I couldn't do anything right. The better I did, the worse I was treated. I was deceitful. I was tricking everyone into thinking I was a good kid. For the life of me, I didn't understand. On 16th of June 1979, a visit from the social worker.
Some 10 minutes with Norman on his own. The incident had clearly shaken Norman. He admitted to difficulties of controlling his temper, but insisted that he had not meant what he said. He did recognise that his mum was under strain, although he didn't know why. Told him some of the reasons, and his response was, "If only I had realised."
I didn't threaten to murder the family. Full disclosure, I probably said to my brother, "I'm going to kill you." Brothers say things like that in the heat of the moment. The following report by my new social worker is from 2nd of November 1979.
Mrs. Greenwood told me that they had been to a parents' evening at school last night and that there had been very unfavourable reports about Norman. She says that she sometimes thinks Norman is amoral. She told me that he smokes, swears, steals, and he seems to harbour a grudge about being black. She said that she was at the end of her tether.
The only report from my high school is from the summer of 1979.
Well behaved in lessons. Always keen to please and has many friends. Norman has settled down well in his first year.
I felt like I'd done everything to show them that I love them. And I'd done everything to show God that I loved God. And they were still my parents forever. Right? On 1st of December 1979, the report records that Mrs. Greenwood called the social worker to take me away. He writes,
"Spoke to foster parents on telephone. Both almost insisted that Norman had to leave today. I explained that we should discuss this. Arranged to see them on the 2nd of January 1980 with a provisional place in Woodfield arranged."
Norman Mills, my social worker, has since told me that he informed the foster parents that having made a commitment to me as their parents, it was not right for them to demand I be taken away. So I didn't go. It was the end of December 1979, when I was excited when I entered the front room for the family meeting, because it was just me and Mum and Dad. I sat at the table, and my mum looked at me intensely. "You don't love us, do you?" I said, "Yes, I do love you. We want you to spend the next day thinking about love and what it is. Read the scriptures and give us your most honest and truthful answer tomorrow." That was it. It was a clear instruction from Mum and Dad. I prayed to God and I read the Bible to see if a passage would answer the question. They wanted me to ask God for forgiveness, and through him I would learn to love them. And in the Baptist faith, a sinner must ask forgiveness for his sins. The theology was perfect, the timing unquestionable, and the answer as honest as a sinner could get. The next day came, and I said it with pride, because I thought I had found the answer that they wanted. "I mustn't love you," I said. I looked at their faces to see if I had said the right thing. "But I will ask God for forgiveness, and I'll learn to love you." This was the perfect answer. "Seek and ye shall find." My mum looked at me as if I had wounded her. "You don't love us? You don't want to be with us?" All of this happened the day after they had made a call to the social worker, who reports,
31st of December 1979. Message left after Christmas saying the Greenwoods wanted Norman removed without further discussion.
My mum wouldn't hug me as I left, so I hugged her. Norman Mills, my new social worker, ushered me gently into the car. The car filled with a quiet loss. Mum told me they would never visit me because it was my choice to leave them, because I didn't love them. This was the beginning of empty Christmas times and hollow birthdays. This was the beginning of not being touched. I'm 12. I said to Norman Mills in the car, "I know this is my fault, and I will ask God for forgiveness." He pulled the car quietly into a lay-by and turned the engine off. "None of this is your fault." I had no idea what he meant. If it wasn't my fault, why could I never return home? Night can't drive out night. Only the light above. Fear can't drive out fear. Only love. My 12-year-old self stood still between two doors in the hall. 2 feet in front of me, the clenched fists of the banisters to a grand staircase, bigger than I'd ever seen. My heart wanted to jump out of my chest and run away back to the Greenwood so that I could tell them all about it. I didn't lean on the wall. My arms were by my side, my shoulders back. I stood like I'd been taught a good boy should stand. Hands out of pockets. Best behaviour. A boy appeared from nowhere. He was shuddering with excitement. "So who da-da-da-da-da are you?" He fired questions at me, none of which I could answer. His name was Jack. "Hello, I'm Norman," I said, and stuck out my hand for him to shake. "How do you do?" Jack stared at my outstretched hand as if I was an alien. He craned his head to the side with a bemused look. He raised both hands and twisted my ears and ran off, whooping with laughter. I was still reeling when I heard the steps of adults. Norman Mills was with Mr. John Harding, a beer-bellied Manchester City supporter. He ran Woodfield's Children's Home. He showed me the dining room and kitchen. The cook switched on the industrial potato peeler. It filled the kitchen with the rumble of thunder. The steel teapot was twice the size of my head. The cellar was daunting. A low ceiling was lined with flickering strip lights. There was a room just a little bit bigger than the table tennis table that squeezed into it. Then the laundrette with industrial steam presses for the bed sheets, and a long walkway with benches and rows of shoes. There'd been many times in the future that I would play table tennis with myself by pushing the table against the wall. Backhand and forehand smash, defend and attack, spin, cut, lob, slice. My body would skip around the table and I'd narrate the game against Christopher, my invisible brother, and I'd let him win. All my personal belongings went in the locker by the bed. I asked when my clothes and toys would be arriving. They were in the trunk back at home, the one with my name on it, the one Grandad Munro made. But nothing was coming from there, not even a Bible. I had nothing to put in the locker. Over the next few weeks, the children's home filled with mainly teenagers. Most children in care have someone they can call family. I had no one. Peter Libby was my first friend. He was half Chinese, half English. He was a year older than me. Libby took one look at me and with a big smile he pronounced in a broadly accent, "Right, Chalky White, that's you." And from then on, Chalky White was my nickname. I loved it. Libby introduced me to the new world. He wasn't necessarily the hardest guy in the home, but he was the funniest. Libby was highly intelligent, like the Artful Dodger. By calling me Chalky, my mate, he was shoring up against what he knew would be a tirade of unbridled racism. If I couldn't take a joke, I would be in for a rough ride. I'll never be able to thank him enough for what lay beneath this christening. Eventually, I came to hate the nickname Chalky White. But I can see now what Libby was doing. There were three huge boys' dormitories on one side of the landing, between 4 and 7 of us per bedroom. I hardly slept for the first month. The sheets were stiff and forbidding. The blankets were scratchy. On 4th of January 1980, the social worker reports.
Saw Norman at Woodfields. He's insistent he wants to remain at Birchall High School. I'm aware that the Greenwoods do not want him to continue there as they feel it would cause problems for their son, Christopher. 18th of January 1980. Norman's very unhappy about the prospect of attending Lee CE Secondary. Still wanting to see Greenwood family ASAP. Norman, however, embarrassed about going home. I offered to make arrangements for a Saturday visit. 26th of January 1980. Norman escorted to foster home. Welcome for him kept on a low key and noticeable that the two older children nowhere to be seen. Greenwoods took Norman back to the children's home, but would not go to the door.
Norman Mills, my social worker, didn't understand that they had no intention of taking me back. I didn't understand it either. My foster parents said that they were my parents forever. They taught me to call them Mummy and Daddy. They trained me. They said they were mine forever because my birth mother didn't want me. They were my mum and dad. The reason I'm writing this book is so they can get a clear idea of what happened. I quickly learned my place with rotors and bells and wake-up time and shoeshine time. My life became a set of systems, and my existence was defined by how well I performed them. No love. I was becoming invisible. I'd been at Woodfields for 11 months. When the giant triangle rang out for dinner, the house sprung to life. Kids raced downstairs from the bedrooms, upstairs from the cellar, dived inside from the garden, off the roof and through the fire escape, every which way to the dining room. 2 hours after dinner was supper time, hot chocolate and a biscuit. After supper, we watched TV in our pyjamas and then to bed and lights out. Christmas Eve, 1980, I wasn't going to ask my social worker if I could visit the Greenwoods for Christmas. I wanted them to ask me not to be alone on Christmas Day. So I did what they wanted. I stayed away. As impossible as it was to understand, I grasped the idea that I wasn't welcome. My social worker reports,
"The unfortunate side effect is that Norman is now refusing to consider any move to another foster home because he cannot face the possibility of another rejection."
Children from homes all over the Northwest were taken to Blackpool to see national heroes Cannon and Ball, starring special guest Lenny Henry. That summer, mid-performance, he said, "I need one of you on stage." A Mexican wave of hands flew into the air. Me, 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 me. But all the children in our home screamed at Lenny Henry and pointed at me. Him, 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 him. Memories in care are slippery because there's no one to recall them as the years passed. I had to check to see if Lenny Henry ever played Blackpool. And there it is, in Wikipedia. "You, what's your name?" Lenny Henry was talking to me. I couldn't reply because the others were shouting, "Norman! Norman!" "Right then, Norman, come up here." Up until that point, I was nervous, but on the stage, I was unafraid. I was home. The stage lights made me shine. Look at this man. He's black like me. And he's a star. My first time on a professional stage was with Lenny Henry. And I can't remember any more than that. By now I was famous at my school and in my area. I was Chalky White. He's up for a laugh. But it was all shielding an onslaught of daily racism. I had to be alert to punches and kicks from strangers, or phlegm flying across the classroom or pavement. I was in fight or flight mode. My main weapon was my smile, my guile, my ability to run. I loved the daily walk from Orchard Lane to high school with our gang from Woodfield down potholed Mill Lane. I loved the school because I could smell family on the other young people. I could sense their mums and dads, their packed lunches, their new football kits. Regardless, I held on to the idea that my parents, the Greenwoods, would come for me one day. But in truth, I was letting the idea go. The last hug from an adult was the stuttered one on the doorstep of their house. I'd been in the children's home for 360 days. I wrote a poem in the dormitory on my first day. It was about a tree. In writing about the tree, I wrote about myself. It was a discovery, a freedom. This is who you are. I knew there and then that I wanted to be a poet. The proof was there, on the paper. The evidence. I was alive. In the children's homes, the written word was rare. There were no books and subsequently no encouragement to read. The staff were too busy adjusting rotas and shifts. The act of writing would follow me wherever I went. At my high school, I was summoned to the office of the deputy head teacher. She had heard about my writing from my English teacher. There were two lights outside the deputy head's office. Red for stay, green for enter. The red flickered out, and after a pause, the green blinked on. Mrs. Jones had the teeth of Ken Dodd and wore jackets and trousers. "Sit down," she said. I sat, sharpish. She stubbed her fag out on her ashtray and walked around her desk. "I want you to have this," she said, and held out a book. It was The Mersey Beat, published in 1967, the year I was born. It was battered and well read. In the first poem on the first page by the poet Adrian Henry. It mentions an orphanage. All I knew about being a poet is that a poet wrote poetry. It's all I ever wanted to be. I was 14. This was a flag in the mountainside, a base camp. But there were more pressing reasons to write. One boy from high school who lived in a house further up Orchard Lane asked, "So where do you live then, Chalky?" I said, "Woodfields on Orchard Lane." He looked at me quizzically. "My dad says it's a den of thieves." It became clear to me that the adults around me had no idea what to do with me. I was surrounded by teenagers who maybe felt the same. The home was bedlam. On 15th of January 1981, my social worker reports.
Visited Norman following a phone call from Woodfield staff. They explain that Norman has again been in trouble. He has accompanied a number of other Woodfield's children in stealing eggs from the kitchens, which were then thrown at the home of a foreign doctor nearby. In addition to this, Norman is still suspected of glue sniffing, whilst his attitudes towards members of staff is beginning to deteriorate. Norman is the youngest of the youths at Woodfield's, and it appears there may have been a lot of pressure on him to be part of the group, and thus to join in the antisocial activities. Spoke to Norman about all this, but he was in a particularly truculent mood and complained that he was being singled out. It was finally agreed with staff that we should attempt to move him to a family group home, preferably Gregory Avenue, in order to remove Norman from the influences of the older youths in Woodfields.
It was agreed with Gregory Avenue staff that I would be moved there in January. "Not lost," said the son at the start of the day, "just following instinct, just finding my way." I hated Gregory Avenue, and I hated being moved. I'd lost everybody again. The adults around me had no idea what to do with me, and that scared me. I was losing respect for them. I was well and truly part of the system. This was not extended leave. I was shown to my new bedroom. I despised the name of this place, a family group home. It was homely in the way a grotto in a shopping store is Christmassy. The staff were on shifts like elves in the grotto. There was an office from where I was passed pocket money each week, and a staff room where the staff smoked and talked about us. I was 14, and I was confused. Norman Mills, my social worker, writes,
"Norman has been particularly prone to swings of mood, which one assumes are largely related to his stage of development. However, he does appear to be harbouring a great deal of resentment concerning the two major rejections in his life, i.e. first by his natural mother and then his foster parents. I feel that this is the source of much of the intolerant behaviour that he displays from time to time."
When I was tucked into bed, the staff wrote their reports. The report seemed only to document anything untoward. My well-being was defined by how many marks were against my name. I was 3 years away from leaving care. I started to ask questions about my origins. A 14-year-old boy should never have to ask the question, "Who is my mother and who are my family?" Because the question comes with others. What did I do to deserve this? Gregory Avenue was in a village called Atherton. I spent 3 years in Gregory Avenue, but as much time out of it as possible, like any teenager. The home was on the edge of Hagfold housing estate. I got to know everyone on the estate. Tony Concannon ran the boxing club in Atherton, and his wife worked in the taxi firm next door to it. I'd spend evenings at their house, smoking, drinking cups of tea with them and their kids. I took whatever affection and acceptance I could from anyone who knew me. I was the boy from nowhere, from nobody, who was everybody's somebody, Chalky White. My social worker records,
"Norman is very interested, naturally, in knowing more about his parents and how he came to be in care. Told him again what I know of the situation and of the difficult position his mother must have faced, e.g. being a young unmarried mother in a strange country. I did suggest the possibility that we could write to his mother's last known contacts in Ethiopia. but warn Norman not to build up hopes prematurely.
I had been on Earth for 14 summers, and to ask me not to build my hopes up was heartbreaking, given that all I had was hope. I was introduced to Bob Marley by a friend on Hagfold called Lyndon Marsh. I was nearly 14 when Marley died and Island Records were pushing out music. Lyndon was a huge fan. He introduced me to Marijuana at the same time. I was spellbound by the album Survival. It flooded into my bloodstream. Marley shouted down the forces of oppression. How can you be sitting there telling me that you care here? In his words, I heard my own story and felt a growing pride. We are the survivors. Yes, the black survivors. He spoke of suffering, history, and of Babylon. He would be my guide. I dropped the name Chalky White. It was no longer a joke. By 1983, I had been in Gregory Avenue for 2 years, and I was becoming what Rastafarians called conscious. I left school with few qualifications and started a Saturday job on a stall at Lee Market that sold household detergents and toiletries. I started in the early morning with a bacon butty and hot tea. I was good in the market. I liked the quick-fire humour and the work ethic of the markets. I was smoking marijuana heavily by now. I graduated from the market stall to door-to-door deliveries. Mr. Waddington drove the transit van, crammed with tubs of bleach and detergents, and from the van I saw a bit more of the world, the reality of the 1980s industrial landscape. I handled money for the first time. To a 15-year-old, it was great work experience. Money in my pocket, the big wide world. During one of the trips around Bolton, selling household detergents on an estate called Dobble, the atmosphere changed. The streets were quiet. The doors were daubed with red swastikas. I tried knocking on a door, then a second. I could hear a baby inside. Footsteps and then nothing. My guts churned. I told Mr. Waddington about the swastikas and he said, yeah, it's where Packies live. No point knocking on those doors. But I felt closer to them than I did to him. There were riots all over England in the 80s. Brixton, Toxteth, Bristol. The last one was in Moss Side, Manchester. The papers were full of rampaging youths. I was the people around me feared the most. I changed, seemingly overnight, from the cheeky chappy, the happy-go-lucky joker, into a threat, and it hurt me. I couldn't unsee the shopkeepers flush red from the neck upwards at the sight of me, or the store detectives following me in shops. At the bus stop, I couldn't unsee the woman clutch her handbag. I couldn't unsee the police cars slowing down deliberately as they passed. I was afraid and angry. The marijuana didn't help. I found another job at a clothing factory. I became an apprentice cutter. The women worked in rows of giant sewing machines like on Coronation Street. They received packages of material from a chute on the floor above. That's where the cutters were. Three old men with tape measures around their necks, and me, the apprentice. There were three long tables, each the size of a billiard table. Raised slightly above the table on a cylinder was a roll of cloth. With chalk the shape of a shark's tooth, I drew patterns onto the material using cardboard stencils. The Eastman cutter was a vertical automatic saw with a finely serrated blade. Put it on side up cloth, that's right, lad, and push this lever down. Now press the red button and cut around the shapes. That's the way. Smoking cannabis at such an early time in the development of my brain was not good, but Anything that would take me away from the madness seemed reasonable. I dabbled in LSD and magic mushrooms too. Other worlds opened up inside me and I couldn't control them. My mental health deteriorated rapidly. I started to walk via back streets. I didn't want to be looked at. The sewing machines at the factory were like tanks drilling into my head. The noise tormented me and I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't smile. I opened my mouth, but nothing. No words. I couldn't go back to work. I could barely walk to the shops. The world started to stutter like a faulty VHS video. My head was falling apart and the people in the home didn't seem to know. They worked in 4-hour shifts. They couldn't see what any parent would have seen in their own child. A mental breakdown. There were 5 days till Christmas. It was the one day in the year where it became obvious that I had no one. My contempt for the adults around me was difficult to hide. One of the staff wrote a report describing abusive language and aggressive behaviour and said she wouldn't be answerable for her actions if it happened again. It was a threat, but it was also a signal that I would have to be moved. 4 days till Christmas. 3 days till Christmas. 2 days till Christmas. On 23rd of December 1983, Norman Mills, my social worker, writes,
"Conference at Gregory Avenue, at which Norman made aware that he was on probation concerning his behaviour and that he would be moved, probably to Wood End, if he stepped out of line again. Norman truculent and negative afterwards, and it wasn't possible to hold any sort of conversation with him. He is allowed to remain at Gregory Avenue for the present."
Meanwhile, my social worker had also been trying to find my mother.
"The secretary, North British Conference of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Dear sir or madam, I'm writing to you in the hope that your church may be able to help a teenage boy in the care of this authority, to trace his natural mother's present whereabouts. Briefly, the facts are as follows. In 1967, a young student named Yemarshet Sise arrived in Wigan from Ethiopia.
Dear Mr. Mills, I've discovered that Yemarshet Sise had at one time been secretary to the principal of our college in Ethiopia. He has suggested you write to the president of our church there."
At Christmas, my social worker gave me letters copied from my files.
4th July 1968. Yemarshet Sise. Ethiopian Union Mission, Addis Ababa. "Dear Mr. Goldthorpe, you might have wondered where I disappeared. I got a telegram telling me I had to come home because of my father's serious illness. I found my daddy at the hospital and it took me a while to recognize him. He is just skin and bone, but somehow he is still alive. Could you please help me in answering the following questions? 1. If I want to get Lem out here, what steps should I take? I would very much like to bring him. Lem needs someone to take care of him. He needs to be in his country with his own color, with his own people. I don't want him to face discrimination. 2. Could you give me his foster parents' address? Very sincerely yours, Yemarshet Sise."
They lied to me. Someone did love me. My mother. Norman Goldthorpe replied to my mother's letter.
2nd of August, 1968. "Dear Miss Sise, I was very surprised to receive your letter and to find that you are back once more in Ethiopia. I realise that it would be best for your son to be amongst his own family, but I must take very great care. He is in very good hands at the present time and is with excellent Christian folk who are doing extremely well for him. I'm afraid that I cannot give you their name and address. This is because they may eventually adopt him."
It didn't take long for my joy at receiving the letters to turn to anger. My birth mother did nothing wrong. She wasn't poor. She wasn't destitute. She didn't abandon me. She did nothing other than find herself pregnant while in England and ask for help. Norman Mills gave me my birth certificate. I looked at my name. It wasn't Norman Mark Greenwood. my Ethiopian name, the name my mother gave me, the name on my birth certificate. I am Lem Sise, I said to myself. My name is Lem Sise. Lem Sise. My name is Lem Sise. My name is Lem Sise. If Woodfields was bedlam, Oakland's was feral, out of control. My anxiety and depression tightened its grip on me. I sought solitude and walked alone at night. I couldn't stop thinking. I found an arch over an old road. No one could see me, so I sang into the reverb of the arch. I sang Marley songs and recited my poems. I became more and more insular. Norman Mills warned me that Wood End had been mentioned, so I told him. I had to tell someone.
February 1984. Norman has now informed me that he is suffering from certain symptoms which I would assess as being of an anxiety-phobic complaint. He walks down back streets to avoid the public in general.